Hi, I'm Kristen.
And I'm her little brother, William.
We're from the podcast Guide to the Unknown, where we only talk about scary stuff and have a good time doing it.
Come join the scary fun, everyone.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find Guide to the Unknown.
Consequence Podcast Network.
My friendship to all of you precludes my involvement with any one of you. But if you want to make love, then I do too, and I'll be right there behind you. All in the name of oath. All in the name of oath. All in the name of oath.
Greetings, constant listeners, and welcome yet again to the Losers Club, a Stephen King podcast from the fine folks here at the Consequence Podcast Network. I'm one of your co-hosts for this episode, Justin Gard Gerber, a former editor, writer at Consequence of Sound, and now a full-time dreamer. But like Ev, Ruth, and Peter's nightmarish experience in the shed, I too appear to be in a permanent nightmare of my own because I'm on yet another episode covering Stephen King's The Tommyknockers, this time the 1993 ABC two-part miniseries. But before we get started, let's head around and introduce ourselves. And you know what? The two people who are joining me this week were not on our book episode, and I know that they've both read the book. So after introducing yourselves, why don't you go ahead and give us your Pennywise clown noses from 1 to 5 on the Tommyknockers novel. Let's start over overseas, a.k.a. in Austin, Texas, with who is this on the phone?
This is Dan, Davy Brown, Caffrey. You know, had I been on the Tommyknockers episode, which through fault of my own, I was originally supposed to be and couldn't, I would have given it 3 bright red Pennywise clown noses, the book, that is.
Wow.
I recognize that it's flawed, but I do admire its darkness, and I think when taken as an addiction metaphor, which is kind of unfair because I feel like so many of Stephen King's books are addiction metaphors, but he's really explicitly come down hard on being like the book that got him to stop doing drugs. With this one, I think there's a lot to like in the book, even though it's very messy. So I'm going to go, yeah, 3 bright red Pennywise clown noses.
Well, I gave my rebuttal in the last episode. Mac, go ahead.
This is Mackenzie Magic Trick Gerber. Mm. And I had a really hard time reading the book. The first third's really good, in my opinion. I'd give it ultimately 1.5 bright red Pennywise clown noses, mostly due to it not being very good.
Wow, some deep commentary here.
But ultimately, I agree with what Justin, I believe, said, was that, you know, this is someone who has had all the hits, and to write something this out all over the place at this point, it's sloppy, and no one was there reeling him in and saying, hey, Stephen, maybe this shouldn't go here, maybe this should go at the end. just blows my mind.
Fair enough.
Real quick, I will say, I almost look at it like I look at Neil Young's experimental albums. Like, they're not cohesive and they're not great, but they give kind of a fascinating insight into what the artist was going through at the time. Although you could argue The Shining does that as well, and is a much better book.
Also,
you guys all give it rating-wise?
Oh, I gave it 1. I think it's the worst book.
What did Randall give it?
Randall gave it 3.5 out of 5, and Mel gave it 2.5 out of 5. Although Mel, Mel hated it much more than I did during the episode, but she gave it 2.5, so that's a whole other episode. I will say this, though, Dan. Are Neil Young's albums 600 pages?
No, they're like 30 minutes usually.
Thank you very much.
That's a good point.
Let me ask you this question. Have either of you seen the Tommyknockers miniseries? And if so, how long had it been since you last saw it?
Dan?
It had been, no joke, I was 7 or 8 when it came on. No, that can't be right.
No, you were probably 9 or so, yeah.
9 when it came. I watched it when it came on at my grandparents' house. And I was looking forward to going into this because I remember liking it quite a bit from when I was a kid. But within about 15 minutes, I was like, all right, I was a kid. I didn't know Dick back then because, well, we'll get to it. But yeah, so I had seen it, but it had been, gosh, I'm 34 now. Just do some Gerberlytics. How long? Years.
Dan, I'm going to say it's been 26 years.
26 years since I've seen the Tommyknockers.
Mac?
I saw it when it first came on as well, probably with you.
Had to have been.
It was right around the time I was really, really getting into Aliens, you know, with X-Files and stuff like that. And I was thrilled to see it. And I remember enjoying it as a kid much more. The only things that stood out to me was the doll sequence and the end, obviously, because I was like thrilled to see the Teenox, as I like to call them.
I can already see the initials, you know, T-K-N-O-X.
I honestly, I don't remember loving it as much as The Stand or It or anything like that, but I did remember liking Jimmy Smits in it, and I just liked Aliens, so I was really excited to revisit it. I was sad to not be on the book episode, because I did read this one alongside Justin and some of the other crew, and I was sad to not be on that episode. However, I get to talk about the Tommy Boys now, so it's all
at long last. It was all worth it to be able to be on this episode to talk about the miniseries.
I've been looking forward to this for 2 years. Don't take this away from me.
When you say Teenox, I'm thinking of the Minox from Empire Strikes Back, which are those aliens that attach themselves to the
ship. Oh, that's right.
Maybe they're cousins, the Teenox and the Minox.
I bet you a drunk Stephen King was watching Empire and was thinking, they say the Teenox?
I think they are cousins because they like to chew on power cables, and the Teenox are very into power.
I will say this, they both chew on my patience. Well, this has been a fantastic introduction, so let's move on to our next section. Let's call up our old friend, Mike Hanlon, at the Derry Public Library.
Mike Hanlon, if you see...
Excuse me, sir! Do you have Prince Albert in a can? You do? Well, you better let the poor guy out!
Mike Hanlon, did I have to go? Did I have to get cleaned up? Tell him I'll see him tonight.
Get out! Last chance, told ya. Get out! Excuse me now.
So, I scour the internet, and there's not a lot of information out there, believe it or not. This is some, you know, deep state stuff going on here. It's hard to find a lot of information about Tommyknockers, but I do want to rattle off some information about the, most specifically, the crew behind the film, and to try to get into the mindset of where they were when they went to production on this. And you have to keep in mind, ABC's It miniseries, which was a two-part miniseries in 1990, was a huge success. You know, for God's sakes, there's a documentary coming out pretty soon about the making of it. Pennywise became an icon, especially the Tim Curry performance.
And this is only like 5 years after the book came out.
This is very short. This is 1993. So in between ABC's It, there were a couple other CBS productions that came out. There was the Sometimes They Come Back movie came out. Mm. Then Stephen King's original Golden Years limited series came out. Oh. But this was the first ABC King property since It. And so they went into it with a lot of promise. They went with a lot of hype behind it because, okay, we figured out the formula. We're going to bring back Lawrence D. Cohen, who wrote It. Mm-hmm. And also he wrote, you know, something called Carrie, Brian De Palma's Carrie. Yeah. Okay. And we're going to bring in Louis Teague, a very good film director who directed
Cat's Eye
and Cujo. So he's got the King background. We got some King background people here. But it all went south pretty quick because according to an old copy of Imagia Movies magazine, which I think was an offshoot of Cinema Fantastique, you know, remember that old might still be around, but I haven't read a magazine in years. The producer of the film, Frank Koenigsberg, said Teague shot a week's worth and was replaced due to a different concept of the project.
Now,
sounds
what
like
the
irreconcilable differences.
What would that have been?
I don't know, because obviously the script, when you start shooting these movies, I always get confused. When you start shooting these movies, you know what the script is, you have the cast in place, so what could have possibly gone wrong? I don't know. Maybe he realized it was a real piece of shit that he was on. I don't know. But here's the most important thing, and I think that this might be the major reason for me, and maybe for the rest of you, as to why this doesn't work, is because he was replaced by a prestigious Australian journalist turned TV director named John Power, who really didn't do a lot before and didn't do much after. He died, actually, a few years ago.
Oh, wow.
And here's the thing. I thought that the budget was slashed or something like that. But from what I could find, both It and the Tommyknockers both had the same budget of $12 million. So why – I asked the two of you, why does Tommyknockers look so cheap? Dan?
That is a great question, because my immediate response was going to be, oh, well, they had more effects they had to worry about because of all the light and the aliens, but not really. Actually, I think it probably has more sequences where they would, that would require like a big budget. And even Tommyknockers, the day-to-day stuff looks cheap too. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's very my biggest beef with this movie is like the camera never moves. There's like no there's no artistry in terms of the cinematography. Everything is just kind of stagnant, and everything is that weird like daytime movie quality about it. It's
no,
just like
I agree.
Right?
It comes across as a gun for hire situation, right, Mac?
So I don't know if there's a reason given that they have the same budget. I mean, it's funny bringing up these id comparisons. Even the opening credits, the title card is the same thing as it. It's the Stephen King and the title coming together, and then they have that kind of almost carnival-y sort of music. Yeah. I wish I had an answer for you. The only thing I could really find online about the Tommyknockers was those funny behind the scenes photos of the aliens. I couldn't even find much that we've all posted.
I agree.
Yeah, I don't know, Mac. Yeah,
it's shot in. I mean, I think it was, what was it, shot in New Zealand.
I didn't get the word.
I think it was shot in New Zealand, and so it's like this town that they just kind of took over. But why does it seem like there's no one in this town? Like, Carradine pops up in like seven scenes, and seemingly for no reason, acting like different people almost. Like, we couldn't get more actors in this movie for $12 million. I mean, think about how many actors are in it. Think about how lived in that town feels.
Yeah,
this does not feel lived in. It feels like everyone's just like there for the weekend. You know what I mean?
It feels like there's like 17 people in this entire movie.
And why is
including
everyone
extras
at the post office? That is the most happening post office I've ever seen in my in a small town. Holy moly!
I think
I mean, I know why I would go with Joe there, but
well, of course, I think aside from the big town square sequence, I think the scene with the most characters is between the magic show and the post office. Everything else is just like, oh, here's two or three people talking, and then
but
and
even
then
the town fair, which I have a great, I can't wait till we talk about that. That sequence. Or I guess when they all gather at the church, you know, Bobby's just talking to like Tracy Lords and Carradine the whole time. Like everyone else is just standing there. I'm like, aren't there other? Couldn't we give some offhanded lines to some of these townspeople? It's so weird.
It's very it feels very soap opera-y, and we'll get into that later on
yeah,
too.
Oh, yeah.
The only thing I can think of is how hot was Jimmy Smith then? Was NYPD Blue a thing back then? Like
this
was either
I think this is right before NYPD Blue, but he was still kind of coming off the success of L.A. Law. Which was a really successful late 80s, early 90s show.
Salaries were expensive. I don't know if that figures into the budget or not. Or maybe those alien suits were a pretty penny. Who knows?
Well, I'll say this. Little nerdy Justin Gerber, when he saw Jimmy Smits was going to be in, I did think, oh, wow, Jimmy Smits is in this. I do remember thinking that.
And I wonder if this is – I think this might be the first thing I had seen him in.
Had to have been.
And I thought he was great in general. I mean,
we'll get to
Smits a lot. So. Yeah, it's really strange.
For me, I think the big thing is, upon the research today, I think it made a lot of sense. I mean, I'm not saying Tommy Lee Wallace is Steven Spielberg or anything, but he's an absolute film director first and foremost. So when he did that TV miniseries, I think he was able to bring a lot of his vision for a bigger landscape. Not to get, once again, too film nerdy here. And then Louis Teague is the same. He's much more well-known for his big screen work. And so when you get somebody like John Power, who is absolutely just somebody who I guess was working on I don't even think he was working on the production at all. This sounds like he was just called in to work on it, who doesn't have a very filmic eye at all. And that's why I feel like there's not a lot of movement, because there's not a lot of vision. I think that they were just kind of on a certain schedule and they had to knock out scenes and that was it.
Get out.
And it shows, and it really, really shows poorly. And like, to liken the way the movie actually looks, I'm not just talking about like the set design, which also looks pretty cheap, but I try to think of if you can go back in the Wayback Machine, let's go back in time together. Like the way Picket Fences looks is like it, in terms of like the cinematography, I guess, and the lighting. And then this looks like Judging Amy or something. You know, I'm not talking about quality of either show. I'm talking about like the way it looks, like the way the light reflects off of certain scenes, and the way like the shadows are never quite really in shadow. You can tell they're on a set. Anyway, that's my briefing on why this movie falls apart, honestly, from the onset. I don't think the cast is actually pretty good in this, but actually, I might be being a little hyperbolic there.
And And the music was done by a former member of Tangerine Dream, I believe.
Wow.
I think he used to be the drummer.
Oh, really?
I think
and
the music's
so
awful.
You think it would be like good. And he went on to score like Babylon 5 and some things like that. And obviously had more of a career down the line. But yikes.
Maybe he was just, you know, teething for this one.
Yeah.
I have to say something. This isn't going to work for anybody listening, but my brother got new glasses. And he now looks like, what if Warren Zevon had short hair his entire career?
Ooh, that's
because he's got like a good beard. He's got the glasses, a black shirt. I'm like, wow, Warren Zevon's here.
Cat Stevens right now with the beard and the glasses.
You look like a like 1990s Cat Stevens.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
We'll get into that later on.
Did your song lyrics suddenly become sarcastic and caustic?
The aliens have come to town.
Ooh.
They're gonna pull out your teeth.
Oh. Why, yeah, I wish Yusuf/Cat Stevens had done the soundtrack to the Tommy. What if that was his big comeback after he converted?
I'll try to write a Tommy song in the vein of Cat Stevens.
Should we call him T-Nox the rest of this episode? Because
I think we're about to move on.
I think I'm ready to talk about some T-Nox. Let's talk about some T-Nox and some of the T-Nox friends and enemies in a segment we call Heroes and Villains.
I'm going to have to kill this fucking clown. Welcome to the Losers Club, asshole!
So I'd like to kick this off by talking about our two leads and some of the differences there. We've got
Guard. I thought it'd be pretty interesting. Yeah, I agree with you, Mac. Let's talk about not only the characters in this who we're all familiar with because they're all from the book.
Yeah.
But let's really get into the differences and whether or not they work for
us.
Yeah,
absolutely. So I felt like for the most part it's pretty faithful. Obviously, for certain reasons, they condense some things and change something. Like, Bobby and Guard are living together. They're like a couple, like, right out the gate.
Makes a huge difference.
Which is, it makes a huge difference in their dynamic, I think, too. I mean, I like the book over this, but you don't have the time to do that. You have a two-part miniseries to tell this whole story, so I understand why they did that. I think it's interesting, all of the choices they made with the alcoholism with Guard, in terms of like how he's constantly really battling it and they don't shy away from that. And then sometimes he beats it, like when he just is so crazed and then just dumps the alcohol down the sink, you know.
He's much more sympathetic in this than he is in the book.
Yes, because in the book, I mean, he is just, up until the end, he is just drinking his life away. I mean, it's crazy.
Well, a couple big things, Mac, in addition to the fact that, yeah, he actually lives in Haven and talks about going home to Haven.
Right, right.
Is the fact that there is no mention of him ever shooting his wife.
Oh, that's right.
Which is probably for the best. I think that was a huge issue that Mel took with the book was that very idea and how they kind of they don't so much gloss. I mean, it's mentioned a lot, but they don't really
go into much
of a retribution for that. He only gets drunk for one night, but he never really falls off the wagon. Whereas in the book, and personally, I think this is actually an improvement because in the book we're introduced to these two characters the first like 100 pages or so. And then we spend the next 300, 400 pages of Guard just really, really drunk and digging.
Yeah.
So at least in this, he's a more active character. Dan, do you understand where I'm coming from in that regard?
No, totally. And I think that's just, like you said, easier to pull off in a book. I think it's easier to pull off this kind of obsession and making digging seem interesting. And also his backstory, because I agree, I think their relationship is a lot more complex in the book, and there's a lot more ups and downs in their past, which I think makes them more sympathetic in a way. But it would be kind of confusing and hard to explain that in a movie. So no, I totally see where you're coming from.
Well, I got really distracted because I'm throwing my brother a pin. Oh, he's found one. This is, you know, we're very professional here at the Losers Club.
We try checking, talking. Down.
Yeah, kill some time, Dan. No, we got some pins here. And in the role of Guard is the aforementioned Jimmy Smits. I will say this about Jimmy Smits. Anytime I find out that he's going to be in a show I watch or is going to be in a show that's debuting, I'm very excited.
So excited.
I'm very excited.
Love Smits.
Of course, he plays the great Bail Organa in episode 2, Attack of the Clones.
But he's good in it. Like he's
good. He's good. He also reprises his role in one of the better films of a couple years ago.
Oh,
Rogue One, the Star Wars story. But no, whenever Jimmy Smits shows up, you know, I'm on board. We've got, in recent years, he's shown up on Brooklyn Nine-Nine. He showed up in the later seasons of a show called Sons of Anarchy. He showed up on one of Dan's favorite shows, Dexter.
Ooh, love Dexter.
Season 3.
Chilling.
mischievous. yeah, obviously though his big role was in the 90s with NYPD Blue.
And then also West Wing.
And the West Wing in later seasons.
He's a great
go-to TV actor, and he's up for anything, and I really love him a lot. I think he's great. And actually, I think he's actually, as I say, actually 15 times, I like him in this role. I think he gives it all he's got. Does anybody disagree with that? I don't think he's not the problem of this movie.
No. It's not like the acting is amazing in the movie, but it's one of those cases of not getting a ton to work with. You know what I mean?
100% agree.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that actors can't elevate lesser material. Well, let's imagine. Think of how shitty this miniseries is. And imagine if it was with someone who wasn't Jimmy Smits, who was lesser than Jimmy Smits or E.G. Marshall or whoever. You know, it would be probably even worse, I'm guessing.
I was liking it too. I always make my Armie Hammer joke, which isn't nice because I think Armie Hammer is actually a good actor, but
yeah, I think
he's very like just kind of vanilla Superman. But anyway, but hey, you know what? The yin to the yang of Guard is Bobby. Bobby Anderson, played by Marge Helgenberger, who...
Species own.
Speaking of aliens.
Yeah.
But of course, she found great, great, great fame after this in CBS's CSI, which I think she was on for over a decade.
Oh, really?
That's her big thing. She was opposite that William Peterson. For those of you CBS and you CSI fans out there, I know there's... Our crossover with CSI is pretty good from all the stats tell us, so...
You know, I liked her as Bobby too. I think they're not the problem for me in this movie.
No.
They're dynamic or anything.
Well,
it's mostly the rest of the town.
But the Bobby change is pretty significant too. When you think about it. Because in the book, by the time Guard shows up in Haven, she's already changed. She already looks awful. But in this, she looks normal for the entire first half.
Well, that's what I thought was interesting. That was a big change that they made was the entire first half, nothing's really happening to the townspeople.
Not at all.
They're just either really smart or, you know, so it was like, I kind of liked that in a sense. I felt like it wasn't doing its job in terms of the scare factor because nothing's happening to these people. All they're being is gifted with this technology and these great gifts in terms of... studying over myself, but you know what I'm saying. Ultimately, I was confused about that. But again, it's a two-part miniseries, so I kind of like the fact that I wish it ended with like one of their teeth falling out rather than it opening the second one with the tooth.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that would have been like, ooh, something's not quite right, you know.
Dan, what do you think about the kind of prolonged becoming as opposed to the more, the quicker becoming from the novel?
I'll say this, I could have used a lot more stuff happening in that first half. Even where we get to when we get to that break, I don't feel like much has happened at all, which once again, if you had really good non-supernatural material to work with, like if the scenes at the post office were compelling, that's one thing. But if nothing else in that first half, I'm like, all right, just throw some aliens in here. Like let's see some of the crazy shit that happens in the novel. And yeah, the TV thing, is that like the craziest thing that happens in the first half? The fireworks,
I
guess.
First half? Well, that's I think the TV thing trumps that. And then obviously Davey's disappearance. But
I think the biggest thing is Becca in the insane asylum, like minutes
well, yeah,
after,
I'll talk about that,
minutes after that happens. So weird.
Well, we're supposed to think it's like a day or two later. She's lost her mind.
Yeah.
But I think the monkey's paw for me is I complained about the book in which we never really spend time with the townspeople at all before they're villains. And that was my big problem with Firestarter, and it's a big problem I've got with this. I don't care about the behind-the-scenes machinations of villainry. I'm more interested in them behind the scenes or being observed by the protagonists. And we get that more in the miniseries. It's still boring as hell.
Yeah, they start...
It tries to solve a problem by creating another problem.
Can we move to two other characters?
Yeah, let's do it.
Ruth and Dugan. I mean, you get them right out the gate.
That's better in this,
and
in my opinion.
And that romance is, it's a little, it's written so awfully.
It's awful, yeah.
It's awful.
But, I sound like I'm contradicting myself, but what I like about the first half, and I know maybe it's been a little while since you've read the book, Dan, but the first half at least tries to make this more of an ensemble.
Yeah.
Whereas Tommyknocker's, the book, doesn't know what it's trying to do. It's been so much time with the two of them in the beginning.
like half and, Bobby and Garb.
And yeah, and then they kind of have chapters for Ruth, but then she's gone. They have these single chapters for people who are eliminated immediately or kind of disposed of. But here they do try to set up an ensemble. They give a lot more time to the Joe and Nancy. We'll get to that, to the Joe and Nancy stuff. And obviously, Ruth and Monster Dugan, a lot more with the Hillmans. So I get what they're going for, and I think Coen did a good job in it of introducing a large ensemble for both parts, even though the second part's not as successful.
And I think what they fail at doing is in that time, you still don't care about any of these characters.
I know.
Like, I don't like, you know, Cara Dean's family at all. I have a bone to pick with Cara Dean in this. I think he's awful in this. And I think he every scene he pops up and I'm just, I just want to move to the next scene.
Well, we'll jump around here. We won't miss anybody, sorry. I promise. But let's talk about Robert Carradine here. Now, Robert Carradine, of course, is best known as, well, first of all, he's brother to Keith Carradine and David Carradine.
Love Keith Carradine.
And he's Lewis Skolnick from the Revenge of the Nerds saga, the quadrilogy.
And that Lizzie McGuire's dad.
Whoa, breaking.
What had he done right before this?
He was doing the Revenge of the Nerds 3 and 4 for Fox.
When was The Long Riders, which is that movie where they...
That was
before Revenge of the Nerds.
I really, really like him in that movie quite a bit.
Here's the thing. I think he's also very good, and you could say he's like an 80s comedy icon in terms of the Revenge of the Nerds. Like, if you see that picture of him in Revenge of the Nerds, you know it's Revenge of the Nerds.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he's miscast here. I think he's quite bad in this. Yeah, I'm not sure how you feel about
him. It's tough. It's a hard watch.
Yeah, well, because it's a lot of him like getting angry and pissed off, but he's still got that kind of nebbish quality about him, you know, like which makes it, I think, difficult to watch. Once again, love Bobby Carradine as an actor, but I think the material, it never gets above like him just being kind of annoyed all the time.
Right.
I wonder what if this was filmed maybe 5 or 6 years earlier, what a Keith Carradine would have done in this performance. I think he would have been a superior.
Love Keith Carradine.
Oh, but then again, I would not want him to be in this because he's still not given a whole lot to do, you know? That's my...
I would have rather had Keith be Guard, but...
On Bryant Brown.
No, Mac, yeah, Mac, if it's like a whole Carradine family, like, yeah, Keith is Guard.
It's like the long writers all over again, where all the sibling actors
David's Dugan.
Mac, real quick, we don't have to spend too much time because she doesn't get a lot to do in the miniseries, so we're not going to give her a lot of time on this podcast, but who plays, is it Ruth? No, what's her name? Bryant Brown's, what's the wife's, what's her name again? She kind of just sulks in the movie. She doesn't get a lot to do.
It's Marie Brown. It's Annie Corley, and I knew her immediately because she is a pinnacle character in episode 1 of West Wing.
Oh, she's the obnoxious right-wing...
Yeah,
no shots to all of our.
She's Mary Marsh.
There we go.
She's the really intense right wing fanatic that the president
has a big speech
at the end of that episode.
And of course, that president is played by Martin Sheen from Dead Zone and Firestarter.
That's right,
so
that's
full
right.
circle.
And I don't mind her in this. I think she's fine. You know, but she's not given a lot. It's just weird. It's weird what we were talking about with everyone not going full Tommy and deteriorating and all that stuff. And it's very obvious why they made that choice, because, you know, obviously a lot of these people just like walk away and they're alive and they're fine, which is not how the book ends at all.
We'll get to that later.
So, but she's fine in this.
Well, let's keep it in the Hillman family and talk about, hey, you know what? The great E.G. Marshall as F. Hillman. I think it's a great casting.
I think it's good casting, but again, this script is just rough. I mean, when he runs into the doctor's room and is like, what's happening to my son? It's just like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, it's a tough one.
I had the same thought when he saw, I think it's in part 2, where he's praying for Davey to come back.
Oh, man, what is that scene?
And
the music in the background, once again, is so bad.
Oh, it's so Hallmark movie. Maybe that's why it feels cheaper, because it's one of Stephen King's most non-sentimental books, and the movie, even though it's kind of close to the novel, manages to be really sentimental.
That's the thing. Like, the book, there's nothing sentimental about the book at all. I mean, it's pretty grim, even if he doesn't remember doing it. But on top of that, it's... The miniseries tries to be really sexy throughout, which the book does not try to do at all.
It Tales.
It's and then I'm looking forward to getting into our little nightmares. Well,
moving on to the children of the family. I think the kid Paul McIver plays a good Davy.
Sure,
he's a good Davy Brown.
Yeah. Davy and Hilly.
I
are
care
good.
About him. Hilly's okay. What I want to talk real quick about that scene when he's doing magic in the schoolroom and the powder puffs up on the professor's face, and he starts saying things like, "Just give me another chance." What are you talking about? Are you trying out for something? What do you mean, give me another chance?
I guess give him another chance to do the trick, I think.
I know, but it's just, it comes off so strange.
What it is, and I didn't really have this realization until talking to you guys. I think what it is that it's trying really hard to do that Stand or Salem's Lot kind of thing where we spend a lot of time just building up the town. And it's not that these scenes need to be extraordinary to be interesting. Stephen King actually writes like common people dialogue really well, but this movie adaptation does not. And so I think because of that, that's why that first half especially seems so boring, because like it is just like this teacher scene. Like what? Yeah, like you said, why are we supposed to be invested in this? The kid fails his magic trick, and I think maybe we're supposed to feel his adolescent pain or something, but I sure don't.
I don't feel a connection to any character in the miniseries or the novel. I will say that. So let's talk a little bit more, though. We mentioned them earlier. Mac mentioned them earlier. Ruth, who goes by Ruth Merrill in this and not Ruth McCausland for some reason. I'm always puzzled by when they change people's names.
Yeah, same here. They do that in
I don't know.
I was watching the Ralph Bakshi Lord of the Rings a couple weeks ago, and they alternate between calling Saruman and Ahriman. It's like really weird. I don't know. But they do that a lot in movies. They'll make these slight changes, and I'm never sure why.
Maybe there was like a John McCausland who was a serial killer when they made this movie or something.
I don't know.
This miniseries. I don't know.
But I like Joanna Cassidy.
I always like Joanna Cassidy. Joanna Cassidy, for genre fans, is, of course, the replicant stripper from Blade Runner.
Yeah. I think it's really strange, though, that scene on the park bench when she's talking to Dugan and he's like, "Oh, no one would ever marry me." And she blatantly says, "Well, I would." And then they get interrupted. And then when they come back, she's like, "I've got to go home." And he's like, "Okay, what? No, she just said that she'd marry you." And then later on, he's like playing coy again. Like, "Oh, well, I'd probably just acting like an idiot." I'm like, no, she just told you like a day ago that she would marry you.
An example of like I said, what I yearned for in the book was building out these characters so we would feel more uneasy seeing them become, quote,
but it's
unquote,
like
become,
they don't know what they're doing.
But they don't know what they're in this. There's not a lot of time.
I like what's his name? The guy who plays Dugan.
The guy who plays Dugan, as we will now call him for the rest of our lives. I forgot the actor's name. It was John something, but he was also John Ashton, best known for the Beverly Hills Cop.
Beverly Hills Cop, yes, yes.
He's the kind of curmudgeon-y cop who has to kind of look over Axel Foley and his partner. I think is Judge Reinhold.
He goes out. I thought that was one of the only effective scenes in the movie.
Well, obviously, in the book, he gets hypnotized into killing himself, so suspicion is not brought to the town. But in this, in typical Stephen King fashion, a soda machine. It's his downfall. Not a floating soda machine, but an exploding soda machine.
He really does love those soda machines.
Or does he hate them somehow?
Well, yeah, apparently.
He's fearful of them. And another big change here is in the shed, it's not the character of Sissy, who is not, thank God, who is not in this miniseries at all. That's a major upgrade, by the way. Yeah. The exclusion of Sissy. The exclusion of many outside forces is a upgrade for the miniseries.
Yeah.
But it's Ruth. In the shed, and I don't think Ruth survives that.
She does not.
No,
which is weird. Why did they choose to do that? You know,
we'll get to that too. But so those are the two things. Somebody else who actually I think gets a lot more to do and is a better character as opposed to the book is Becca Paulson. Mac, you look up her name. This actress was in
Alice.
Big thing was
Alice Beasley.
Alice Beasley. Her big show was Moonlighting in the 80s.
She's a good character actress, and I like her in this role. I just feel like I like when they're like dressing and dolling up Ruth. I mean, they do try really hard to make you like these.
And
people.
She works at the police station. She's not just some King describes these quote unquote like these grotesque overweight women in his books who are like Jesus freaks, and that's literally what she is in in the book.
Yeah,
but here she's a working woman. She's got a good sense of humor. She's really sweet, you know.
I really do like the change because of the way that they changed that character. I like that she's watching the talk show.
Yeah.
You know, or the game show, yeah. And then how the game show is what talks to her. I did like that sequence. It's not as creepy as Jesus talking to you, but
we've had Jesus talking a lot, you know, and it's good to see some 1990s commentary into those Fox game shows creep their way into ABC miniseries.
Yeah.
Dan, from what you can remember, how do you like the character of Becca Paulson compared to the book, the short shrift of the one chapter she gets in the book?
I'm gonna cop to it. I don't really remember her all that much in the book.
Well, I can't blame her. She's literally in one chapter.
Yeah, and it's funny because I reread Misery and I'm reading The Dark Half now, but I'm still working on finishing The Tommyknockers just for how big of a sucker that is.
Well,
but although the book is easier to read than the miniseries is to watch for me.
Well, I guess the thing with the miniseries, I'd already seen it before, and I knew that no matter what happens, I would be done in 3 hours. Whereas it took me weeks to read the book. So I think that's why it was easier for me to watch the miniseries, even though it took me a whole day to break it up. Speaking of the Paulsons, I mean, holy Lord, Joe Paulson and Nancy Voss get a lot, especially Nancy Voss, get a lot more to do in this miniseries. Let's talk about the casting here, though. And there is some sex. We got sex in the mailroom multiple times. We got sex on a picnic bench. We'll talk about the pound cake later on. But, Mac, I forget the actor. You know, it's funny. We brought up the actor who plays Joe because he was in a film by the director of – it's Cliff DeYoung. Cliff DeYoung was in a movie directed by the person who directed Children of the Corn 3, Urban Harvest. We discussed him briefly in that episode. I'm sure everybody listening to this episode definitely listened to that Lobstrosity episode.
It's funny because the day before I watched this, I watched The Hunger with David Bowie and Susan Sarandon, and he's in that too. So I just thought, what are the chances of watching two Cliff DeYoung movies back to back?
Cliff DeYoung, best known for me as the father in Flight of the Navigator.
Oh, that's right.
He was also in a film called Shock Treatment, the sequel to Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Oh,
he
Shock
plays
Treatment.
Brad in the sequel.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
He's been in a lot. He still pops up from every now and then. He's a good character actor, but, you know, and then, hold on. Nancy Voss is played by Tracy Lords. Now,
and this would have been like peak Tracy Lords,
absolutely. This was about less than a decade after. Tracy Lords was a very, very, very famous porn star. In the, was it late 70s, early 80s, I guess, or just maybe the early 80s?
I think the 80s. And she lied about her age, right? That was the big thing.
She was underage in a lot of those films. And so there's a big controversy about that. And she was kind of drugged out of her mind during that period. And very dark stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But she actually has gone on to have a pretty successful career, not even in B movies, but she's popped up in some mainstream stuff over the last 30 years.
She's in Blade. I remember her being the first Blade.
She's in the rave scene at the beginning of Blade. She was in this really bad horror movie about this this kid who gets possessed by a demon and becomes a rock star. I'm not talking about Trick or Treat. I think it's called Shock 'Em Dead or something like that. Anyway, it's a real shit movie, but she's in it too.
I'm reading right now too. Apparently, she has a song on the soundtrack for Pet Sematary 2 called "Love Never Dies," which I don't know what that sounds like off the top of my head.
I'm sure we made fun of it in the Pet Sematary episode.
Did. I remember that. Yes.
Anyway, so yeah, Nancy Voss. I mean, she basically in the book, she's just another one of the hive mind Tommyknocker, the T-Nox.
The T-Nox, yeah.
And in this, you could argue she's like the second villain of the miniseries.
Yeah, it's really strange that why they gave. I think it was they needed some actual people being the villains, so they stepped that up quickly. They stepped that up much quicker.
Yeah.
In this, when she uses the lipstick zapper, another great and funny scene though when at the town hall meeting in front of the church, the T-Nock meeting. When she says, that she got rid of the cops, Bobby says, and I quote, like, hold on, let me pull this up. She says,
you don't have the quote?
I have it.
Read it.
I'm trying to find it.
Oh, we're keeping all this in there.
I thought you were
saying we are no hive mind here as Mac looks up the T-Nox quotes.
I've got a quote. We're doing a pound cake section later on.
Ultimately, Bobby says something like, you know, it was unnecessary to zap them. This script is just fantastic.
I love it. I love it all.
Tracy and Nancy and Joe all over this, banging it out in every room, every chance they get. You really do feel bad for Becca because of what's going on in the. I mean, they do a good job of like you feeling bad for her.
The sympathy is all with her, and you're much more okay with her.
You're ready. You're ready for Joe to go.
Well, you mentioned the zapping of one of my favorite characters in the book, Benton Jingles, who definitely don't mark the turn for me in terms of going downhill pretty quick. But something I do like about this miniseries is there are no flashbacks. It just goes from point A to Z. So if you've not read the book, you have no clue as to what's going to happen. Whereas in the book, my God, time is all over the place in that book, especially in part two. So I'll give them that. Some other major differences, though, in terms of the characterizations I want to bring up. As we mentioned, there's no Sissy. There's no John Leandro. There really aren't a lot of outside forces at all. This is a very sectioned-off book, and I think it actually worked. It could have worked better because of that. I think that was a big problem I had with the book. There's no Altair 4 mentioned. David is actually powering. He's in the ship. He could power the ship.
Right. He's like and a battery
honestly,
of the ship.
I didn't mind that. That wasn't a big detriment.
It's fine. That's fine. I actually like that change. Yeah.
Ev kills Nancy by breaking through the cage. There's not some big. In the book, there's a huge climax of the whole town using all of their devices to try to kill Guard before he gets to the ship.
Right.
But in this is very much people show up at the ship, but it's too late and there's nothing they can do about it. Something that I really think is just absolutely lame and unforgivable, and I'm assuming the two of you will agree, is what happens with Bobby at the end.
Where
he looks her in the eye and essentially gets her to transform back to Bobby by saying, I know you're still in there. And then, of course, Bobby rescues Peter and they both live.
I'm defending this. She hesitates, but then when he kills that T-Nox, she gets her energy back.
Oh, yes.
That's what happens.
Still lame.
So you find out that the T-Nox have been using each individual person in the town to come back to life, basically. So they've been sucking their power. That's why they've been deteriorating and their teeth are falling out, which is, you know, makes more sense. I think in the book, obviously, they're turning into T-Nox, some kind of weird version of a T-Nox, I guess. But,
well, we'll talk about that in the Nightmares and Dreamscapes part. But to give them the easy out of rescuing Bobby, I'm guessing the whole town, and Peter lives. It's just such
the book, Guard shoots her, right?
Yes, he kills her. Right? It's brutal. And I know it's a divisive issue. I think Randall and I kind of like the darkness of that, whereas Mel did not like the treatment at all of Bobby throughout the entire book, so I understand where she's also coming from. But they give them such a romantic ending here, and it's so cheesy and emblematic of what's wrong with Hollywood or ABC adaptations, you know?
It's once again taking a book that is not at all about sentiments. Regardless of whether Bobby gets killed or not, like, the book is not about sentimentality. I think it's about addiction and obsession and get it. And now, Grant, I get why maybe that might not make everyone's favorite movie, but the movie goes so far in the other direction with that ending that I think it's really hard to stomach.
I agree 100%. Yeah. Does anybody have anything else to say about the characters before we move on to our next fun session?
Let's move on.
I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about the rest of them.
Oh, we'll still talk about the characters.
I know there are.
As we enter into that dreamscape. Nightmares and dreamscapes.
If you think your dreams are disturbing, imagine the nightmares of Stephen King.
What are you, some sort of a horror movie guy?
No, Clyde, I'm a literary guy.
So this part, we're just going to talk about, like we haven't already for the last 40 minutes, things we didn't like about this miniseries. Let's think of specific things, not just grand themes that we've talked about ad nauseum. Mac, can you kick us off?
My favorite scene in the movie is when, at the end of part one, when they're having the big July 4th parade, and Ruth is addressing everyone and telling them basically, like, we've had a really hard year, like Davey's missing, all these people. And they still have the like upbeat marching band music playing in the background. Like, they couldn't just have someone turn that off or stop the band if there was a band while she's telling the town about these awful things. It's so funny. Go back and watch that scene. I was dying laughing.
The tone is not consistent throughout the miniseries. Dan?
I know I mentioned it, but I want to elaborate on it a little bit. All right, so E.G. Marshall praying to return Davy Brown. For obvious reasons, I mean, there's the corniness, the music, how long it goes on, all that. And that's no shade to E.G. Marshall, who's great in Creepshow. He's great in everything else. I think because he's looking skyward, all I could think about was that scene in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation where he's staying in Rusty's bed and Johnny Galecki's bed. And he's like looking at the ceiling. You don't know what he's looking at. And they pan up and he's staring at some like hot poster, like an 80s babe. And so I just like, on top of that scene sucking anyway, like I just couldn't take it seriously at all. So that's, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if that's the worst thing. There's a piece of pound cake that is pretty bad that I'll save. But that's the thing I just kept like laughing at and kept thinking.
Now, you know, it's because, you know, as you know, I watch the Tommyknockers miniseries annually. So now from now on, every year when I sit down around February to watch it, I'll think of that scene. I've got something here, and Mel brought it up in the book episode, but that the standing ovation for Guard's poem.
bad. Sleazy like, guy like the in slow, the coat.
It's the slow clap, and then everybody starts to clap. It's so generic and base level boilerplate studio drama. It's unbelievable.
Did you notice that the first guy to stand up and clap is the guy that ends up serving him drinks at the
party. No, so probably, they're on the house, Mr. Gardner.
It reminds you of like in Decker, and where Decker sings the karaoke song, and they're, oh my god, because this poem kind of sucks too. You know?
Way to go, man.
Exactly.
Oh god.
Matt, you have something else here.
Yeah, that line I was talking about is actually, zapping them was unnecessary. My favorite scene is when Ev is researching the Micmac woods and finds out they're cursed. Something he tells Hilly in the first scene we see him in. It's like, what is the revelation here? You knew they were cursed. You told him that in the beginning. It's so stupid. Well,
and that does tie to it. Even though I gave the book a higher rating, I think one of my main issues with the book, and thus the miniseries, is that Stephen King never quite settles on what kind of horror he wants to embrace. Like, it's like, okay, it's aliens, but it's also kind of like the Indian burial ground thing. And then it's sort of creepy dolls. It's just like all over the place, you know what I mean? Like, that was something even as someone who likes the book a little bit more, I remember being frustrated about like, all right, like what is this exactly? You know what I mean? Yeah. Not that we have to know it's aliens right away, but just it feels very scattered.
It's a greatest hits, you know. It's a greatest hits. Matt, go ahead.
Yeah. No,
the Bobby Guard axe fight at the end is totally laughable.
Oh, in the spaceship.
It's just so such a departure. It's like, what is going on?
I think I don't like that Bobby and Guard are just in a straight up. I use generic again, but it's the fact. The safe relationship already. They live together. I like the dynamic from the book much more. I think that's something that they changed I do not like.
Yeah.
I have a question for you guys since we're kind of good or bad parts. How do you feel about the actual aliens? Which I know they in the book they don't come to life like they do in the
They don't come to life at all in the book.
I have to say, I actually don't mind the creature design. I actually thought the aliens held up kind of well, better than the human stuff does. But what about you guys? Are they totally cheesy looking too?
I'll just say this reeked of, if Dino De Laurentiis had produced this, this was definitely a moment where he was probably like, hey, Lewis Teague, Larry Cohen, we got to get the aliens in there. We've got to get the aliens. And like, that's the whole point of the book, is that they're all dead and they've been a dead species. No, we got to get a big alien like from the Ridley Scott movie in there. That's what it reeked of to me. Like, well, we got to have aliens, guys. It's about aliens.
I think it would have just been really effective had we seen even just the... I like the shadow of the alien, you know, like they're coming alive. They are coming back, but we don't actually ever really see them. I think that would have worked a lot better for me because, I don't mind the creature design, but again, it's just, you know, they show way too much of it. I wish it was in the dark more, and that's clearly like a soundstage, you know?
I agree. I have something else here. I know it was impossible due to the budget, I guess, but one of my favorite parts of the book is the fact that they are slowly turning into aliens, and there's some great gross body horror going on in that book,
yeah.
Which, you know, if you, I'm assuming you've read the book or listened to our episode, so go back and listen to that. But I don't like how here they basically just become paler and kind of lose teeth. You know, that was a little disappointing. But obviously there's only so much you can do with the budgetary constraints that I'm sure that they had.
Right.
Dan, do you have anything else?
I think that's it. I feel like I'm forgetting about something really horrible.
I remember something, Dan, if I can jump in. When Bobby's at the vet, we've got every animal in there. We've got owls. We've got dragons. We've got cobras. I mean, it is fucking nuts.
In Maine?
For such small town.
Now, granted, was there like an alligator in there or something?
No,
I'm telling you, there's like a giant like Komodo-looking dragon in there. You're like, what the heck? I mean, I know this is New Zealand, folks, but holy shit.
Yeah, this
is
really
not indicative of a pet, a vet. Like, crazy.
A couple other things. I like how the book really leans on the fact that it's sci-fi by just having it be a flying saucer. And then this is just a bunch of columns sticking out of the ground.
So weird. Like, I don't like the whole box factor of the boxiness of it.
I figured they could have saved a lot of money if they just made it a dome.
Well, the thing she trips on in the beginning just looks, it really does just look like a gutter pipe or something underground. So it's just like, why would you even investigate this further? Except for when she touches it, I guess.
But, and I guess I watched it growing up, but are we supposed to believe that it's the fireworks that truly infect the townspeople because they're all looking at them?
Yeah.
As opposed to the book where it's just kind of bleeding from the ground and slowly possessing them.
It was already doing that. Well,
isn't
sorry,
there something about like a clock tower? Like the clock tower takes off like a rocket ship, right? But that doesn't serve the same function as the
fireworks. That's just to alert outside people that something's going on in the town. But in this, this is, it's supposed to be like, okay, now they're all becoming infected. Yeah.
That's kind of lame too. Oh, can I end this section on the quote of the film for me? The great quote from this movie?
Sure.
Please do.
It's just before Bobby escapes with David. She looks at guard one last time.
Oh my God, I wrote this too.
All right, here we go. Ready? It wasn't the plate that kept them out. It was you.
Oh, man.
The thing of nightmares and dreamscapes. What better way to wrap up that section? So let's move on to a section that will find us discussing things that we actually found effective and quite scary. In some instances, we're going to take a trip to the cemetery.
What's the bottom of the truth?
Well, sometimes that is better. The person you put up there ain't the person that comes back. It may look like that person, but it ain't that person. Because whatever lives in the ground beyond that cemetery ain't human at all.
Yeah. There's some stuff in here. I actually...
Let's go in the circle if we've got a couple minutes.
Yeah, so for me, I actually think it's pretty creepy, the doll sequence, when the dolls start killing Ruth, the thing that they're saying over and over again to her.
Yeah, you know, I think that's
too
actually
late,
pretty
too
good.
Too late, Ruth, or something like that. Or I actually thought that worked. I mean, it's out of place. It doesn't happen in the
book, but
they don't attack her. They don't attack her in like
the bats attack her.
But they talk to her. But I kind of liked that. There was some good puppetry.
Well,
because
I liked there's some puppetry, and I liked the fact that there were different types. There was a Raggedy Ann. There was a Nutcracker.
That was the scariest one.
That kind of worked pretty good. Okay, I'll go next year. I still think that opening, and it kind of recurs throughout the miniseries, of guard dreaming and running in the woods, and her turning around with the green eyes. I remember watching that miniseries, and I thought, this is going to be a very disturbing 4 hours. I think that's the creepiest part of the whole miniseries, is that opening when she turns around, looking emaciated in that hoodie with the green eyes, and you're just kind of left in this, what is happening here?
Yeah,
I don't know. Dan, what do you think?
Creeped me out when I was a kid, yeah.
Man, I got to be honest. I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm trying to think with part two, especially. I was zoning out. I mean, I don't know. I like that creature design. I I imagine to see him freaked out by it, because there's like no point where I was like, ooh, that's creepy. Okay, all right, I got one. It wasn't as effective this time around, but when I was a kid, I remember Jimmy Smits being launched into space and his nose bleeding profusely, and knowing he was going to die is kind of disturbing me. But I don't know, that was a lot more cheesy this time around, yeah, too. Like, you know what I mean? Like, as a kid, I remember being like, ooh, this ending is really dark and cool. But
well, you know, I will say, though, about that ending, is a big problem I had with the book is that it's all that fucking work for 600 pages, and he just has to put on some headphones to take off. In the movie, yeah, though, I mean, this thing, he puts on whatever, but it drills its way into his head. So that's a little more damaging, a little more scary and violent, as opposed to just putting on old Panasonic headphones and going off into space, you know?
Yeah. I guess I'll go with that. That's like my pick.
Mac, I've got one more, Max, if you want to list off whatever else you've got.
Yeah, well, just on the guard thing real quick, I was just going to say that I do remember that being one of the first things I saw where, like, the hero just sacrifices himself or dies. Like, I just remember that being really off-putting to me that he didn't survive because, you know, I liked him as the hero.
Kind of
but going back to the scary stuff and stuff that did work, I still think Peter paddling in like,
oh,
the tub,
yeah, that still works.
Is still creepy. Like, he's when he's hooked up to the machine.
That's sad.
Just like dog paddling forever.
And,
like,
and in the
creepy
book, Peter dies in the book too, right?
Yeah.
Hey, I do hate when dogs die.
Hey, look, don't get me wrong. I hate when dogs die, but it was obviously more effective that he dies in the book. We're now silent. I've got one last thing I can close it on.
Okay.
In the miniseries, which once again takes place in New England, right? It takes place in Haven, New England. Hilly wears an Oakland A's hat. There is no way in hell that kid will be allowed to walk around town wearing an Oakland Athletics hat.
I have a question for you.
It's Red Sox or nothing.
I might push back. Well, maybe this isn't the same. All right. So when I was a little kid, I was 8. I was living in Clinton, South Carolina. And I really wanted a baseball hat from the gas station. And I chose the Oakland A's, not because I knew anything about baseball or sports in general or the A's, but I just thought it looked cool. So I was in South Carolina wearing an Oakland A's hat. But well,
do you know why? Because there are no teams in South Carolina, and two, the Boston Red Sox fans don't live in Clinton, South Carolina. There's not a big Boston Red Sox fan base in Clinton, South Carolina.
Yeah.
Well, isn't it weird? I've also been in Clinton, South Carolina for some reason. Maybe I was driving through.
Really?
Yeah.
Do they still beat kids at school? Because that happened when I was there. corporal punishment was
South
legal.
Carolina. I'm going to go on a limb as somebody who lived in the Carolinas, so I can say this and say, I believe everything you just said.
Yep, I remember making myself vomit before school so I wouldn't have to go because I was so afraid I was going to get hit. But hey, we'll save that for another.
Yeah, that's our next episode where Dan talks about his childhood. Well,
what Dan just said is far more disturbing than anything in this section. I think the sun is rising. I think it's time to head out of the cemetery. And I'll tell you what, though, it was a long night there. Maybe because I had the dirt all over me because I was in a cemetery. But I have to say, I am starving. Is anybody else starving?
Yeah, I'm pretty hungry.
Damn.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, definitely.
Let's skip our meal and head straight to dessert. I'm stumbling. I'm so excited. Let's have some pound cake.
After all you've been taught,
everyone in Bad Mama, everything in the sin.
Come to your closet and pray. Ask to be forgiven.
He's a nice boy, Mom. You like him. You really like him, Mama.
Dan, I'm curious. You said that there was something you wanted to mention, I think maybe quote-wise. So you go first.
It's when you start hearing their thoughts in the post office. And I think it's who's the guy, Tracy Lords?
Joe. Yeah.
I think it's him. Maybe I'm paraphrasing. But she hears something like, oh God, I haven't been this horny since I was 16. Or
yes.
Remember he says the word horny unironically, which always makes me laugh. I that was the most entertaining part of the miniseries for me.
I do love the earnest use of horny.
Yeah, because he says it too, like, oh, like, I'm so horny. Like, it was great.
Even Tracy Lords, even Nancy says something like, God, he's so hot. And I just thought,
what? Yeah.
I thought,
no offense.
What?
To Cliff
are we
DeYoung
talking about? No offense. Like this is like not this like strapping, you know, hottie, you know, like, and I don't buy that she's with him. I don't buy that she works at the post office. I don't buy a lot of this movie. But yeah, that whole relationship's so bizarre.
Well, the sex throughout the miniseries is so out of place. It's goofy as hell.
I think the thing too is like, you know, I think it'd be bad of us to say like, oh, like a guy like that can't get a woman like that or vice or blah, blah, but.
I don't think they can.
Well, no,
I'm kidding.
For me, it's more like the miniseries traffics and stereotypes the entire time.
Oh, yeah.
And so it feels weird for that one relationship to be kind of like off kilter a little bit. I don't know. It's, but yeah, the talk to, I mean, there's not like any graphic nudity really, but there's a lot of pound cake in this for being a network. TV miniseries. Yeah, well, what about you guys?
Yeah, the Bryant and Nancy hookup near the end. Do we need that?
Because we needed Carradine to be in more sequences.
we don't
care about that character. He's a total asshole in the beginning when he is a regular person. So seeing her like get it on with him after the fact, it's like, well, who cares? Because he's already an asshole.
You're reminding me
what
of...
What do we care?
You're reminding me of... later on in with Harold and Nadine in The Stand in the miniseries, that kind of dynamic of him inventing
kind
of something and
stockings, like Skinemax.
Real hot stuff.
I guess that's the one thing I thought was really interesting was like the Tinox seemed to like get everyone really sexually charged up.
Guys, when I was looking for the exact what that quote was, and what came up, I just had to like Tommy Knockers, like, I'm so horny or something. And some message board about the Tommy Knockers came out. And so someone just wrote, like, yeah, apparently the Tommy Knockers make everyone horny.
They do, apparently. It's so weird.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, Bobby. And she's just like really horny. Like, she's not even doing it for any reason. In the book, it makes sense. But,
well,
like,
I'll say this, though. You know, the old urban legend that says, you know, like, isn't it Mountain Dew? If you drink a lot of Mountain Dew, does it get you horny, or is it the opposite?
Are you saying because the Mountain Dew's green?
Yeah, exactly. Tommy's green.
T-Knock drink?
T-Knock.
Well,
choice of the T-Knock.
The actress playing Bobby being in both Species and this is, you know, people who get hypersexualized by aliens. I mean, it's a. She's cornering the market.
Oh, there's a little trivia I forgot to mention here, too. And that is, do you know who the driver is who gives Gar that lift into Haven at the beginning of the movie?
I do not.
He looked very familiar to me because I knew that he used to be the president of the Screen Actors Guild.
Oh.
And listen to this. He's Alan Rosenberg. He's uncredited. But not only was he the SAG president, and you know me and my deep knowledge of the Screen Actors Guild, he also appeared in L.A. Law with Jimmy Smits.
Hmm.
More importantly, guess who he was married to at the time?
Yeah.
Mark Heldenberger, who played Bobby.
Really?
So there you go. A little trivia for all you folks out there who are probably screaming this entire time. Please mention him. Please mention Alan Rosenberg.
Do you have any further pound cake? There's quite a lot of it in here.
I mean, there's a lot of it, but a lot of it's so... repetitive. There's not a whole lot to really dive, to really sink our teeth into, I guess you would say. Mac, nothing.
I thought it was really hot when Jimmy pulls his own tooth out. I don't have anything else.
All right, well, let's get the hell out of here. Let's move on to one of our last categories. I'm really upset to have to stop talking about T-Knox, but let's move on to King's Dominion.
There's another world out there.
I know there is.
I've only got one.
Really?
Off the top of my head.
I got a few.
The line when Ruthie's like talking about Peter and she's like, oh, you know, he's acting like a regular Cujo.
that's it.
I thought that was pretty great. What are the other, were these, other than the fact that it takes place, or the dairy and all that, like in the book, but
well, yeah, dairy is mentioned.
Okay, yeah,
like,
yeah
they didn't have to mention dairy.
Oh, okay, that's
mentioned.
That's true. Go ahead,
Dan. You've got something. I've got a couple more.
Yeah, it was the Cujo reference and then dairy. I didn't think they had it in the miniseries, but I was really hoping I was misremembering, and we would get that scene where Pennywise is on the side of the road waving with the balloons. But we didn't get that.
So good in the book. So good.
Yeah, especially if they're trying to connect this to it, you know, that's a good way to do it. But
well, I'll tell you what, I'm answering my own question here with my notes. Remember earlier I asked, why do we think that they changed Ruth's last name?
Yeah, why did they?
Well, let's think about this. What other character in the Stephen King universe has the last name Merrill?
Oh, Ace Merrill.
Maybe that's why. Maybe that was a little joke.
I can see that. Yeah,
that's fine. That makes sense. And it's also Castle Rock. And well, not this isn't Castle Rock, but it's close enough, you know? Yeah. All right, that's fine. I put that down as a little King's Dominion. Obviously, you mentioned earlier that the Mi'kmaq tribe, which is a huge part of Pet Sematary, is mentioned. And something we mentioned in the novel episode, the G.I. Joe character Crystal Ball is mentioned. Guess who came up with the idea as a kid and won the contest in the 80s? Owen King.
Oh.
And so Crystal Ball was an Owen King invention. And I think there was some trade-off where somebody else was kind of named after Stephen King or something like that. Anyway, you can look that up online. But Crystal Ball also routinely voted as one of the worst G.I. Joe characters in the history of G.I. Joe. I don't remember much of him. I don't believe I had that
character. I don't think I remember that.
I didn't even remember that being a character.
I wasn't as much in it. I was more of a Transformers kid.
Yeah, I remember the fridge over that. But
Dan was much more of a T-Forms kid. We were a bunch of T-Noxes.
PB and T-Forms, yep.
Well, that's all I've got for King's Dominion. I think it's time to, at long last, put this T-Nox to rest by moving on to our final thoughts.
Dad, can we go now?
You ready?
Yeah, we've been ready for an hour.
Okay, I'll be right there.
He said that a half hour ago.
Yeah, my dad's weird. He gets like that when he's writing.
Mac, would you like to kick this one off? On a scale, of course, from 1 to 5, bright red, Pennywise, clown noses.
I'm going to go with a 1. I'm giving this worse than the book. Because at least the book had that quarter of good stuff with Guard Bobby in the beginning. This is just, it's just a tough, it was a hard watch. I spent most of the time like taking notes and looking at my phone, like letting it pass by me, and it just before my eyes, it was just droning. And it was just, for only being a two-part miniseries, it felt longer than The Stand. I didn't really love it at all. The aliens didn't hold up for me. I wish they had. Some of the performances are decent, but it didn't work.
Dan.
Yeah, you know, I feel like I'm often the one who is pretty lenient on grading, but I'm going to go with a 1 as well, man. I could have dealt with it being outdated. I could have dealt with corniness, but do anything but bore me. You know what I mean? And this was, at the end of the day, for the smallest positive things I had to say about this, this was a boring, boring slog. Like you, Justin, I had to break it up into like 4 or 5 sittings, I think, over 3 days. It was really hard to get through. And I like Jurassic World, you know? So, exactly.
So, you know, Dan did not like this.
It was bad. Yeah. What about you?
Well, for me, I was bullied into giving Tommyknockers a 0, even though we always say it's a scale of 1 to 5. So really, I gave it a 1. And for me, I mentioned all the things I liked, quote unquote, liked. I found a lot of this to be one step forward, one step back. Anything that was improved upon was made worse, ultimately, or something else was made worse. Another decision was made worse. And you know, not to get too repetitive, but I just found it to be very, it was the boring miniseries equivalent of the boring book. And I too will give it a 1 out of 5. That's right. I believe that Children of the Corn 2 and 3 are better than the Tommyknockers miniseries. And I am not afraid to say it.
I would agree.
So
Children of the Corn 2, I mean, once again, it has a lot of interesting stuff in it. There's some genuinely freaky scenes, but.
And 3's got some good special effects.
Yeah.
Before we go, we should also mention that I just realized the Tommyknockers will never be behind us because, damn it, James Wan, whose Aquaman was a huge hit, is going to be producing a Tommyknockers movie that we should probably expect to see within the next year or two.
Oh, isn't it called The Trench?
No, that's the Aquaman spinoff.
I know, but those things look just like the T-Nox.
But yeah, I mean, they've got a writer hired. I don't know if James Wan's going to direct it, but you bet your butt out there, you bet your little butts, that because of the Stephen King renaissance, we are absolutely going to see a Tommyknockers movie in the next year or two. So we've got that to look forward to.
Real quick, who's Guard and Bobby?
I can't even begin to imagine that. I'm trying to block it from my mind, much like Guard tries to block his memories and thoughts from all the T-Nox in Haven. But, well, listen, I've had a great week talking about the Tommyknockers for hours, but it's time for me to put on some headphones to let them drill themselves into my head and fly off into that beautiful Milky Way out there and blow myself up. Because this has been a long process. We've been talking, all joking aside, though, this is one of the earliest things that I believe, especially Randall and I, were talking about getting to Tommyknockers and having a nice discussion about it. And it was a lot of fun going back and forth with him, and obviously going back and forth with you two and Mel. So the Tommyknockers is behind us, but don't worry, we'll be back in Haven before we know it, I'm sure. So the next book we'll be covering, which will be airing, I guess, in about a month or so, is The Dark Half. And spoiler alert, I've read it before, but I'm actually enjoying it quite a bit so far. Again, there's a lot to glean from that, especially if we've, after this big reread we've been doing in terms of where King was and the whole Bachman thing. But we won't talk about too much in case you haven't read it, but definitely start reading that. We are returning to Castle Rock for that book.
It also is the last of the King 80s books.
You're right, because before we know, we'll be talking about the
Kingies. Oh, is it really?
Yeah. Isn't that insane?
King is right around the corner.
Kingy is right around the corner. Please rate and review us on iTunes and wherever you rate and review your favorite iTunes shows, your podcast shows. There's nothing left to say besides, of course, that wonderful line, it wasn't the plate that kept them out, it was you. But I will say this, and I'd like the two of you to join me. Long days. And pleasant nights.
I don't know if we'll ever get that right.
Yeah. It's hard. It's all about the eye contact, which I don't have right now. So, yeah.
Bye, T-Nox. I got some hot friends. 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 But you know you want somebody to treat you good.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform, or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM Podcast Network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.